You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of The Godfather Presidency by Sam Tannenhaus. The pattern was established under Trump 1. It was the life of lies, as former FBI Director James Comey would describe it in 2018 in his book A Higher Loyalty. Comey's years prosecuting mobsters in the 1980s and 90s were prelude to his dealings with Trump and those around him. The silent circle of ascent was the same, as was the feeling of the boss in complete control. Holy crap, Comey recalls, after an early meeting with Trump, they are trying to make each of us an amica nostra, a friend of ours. Trump first wooed Comey, then vilified him, then summarily fired him, and followed it all with a prolonged campaign of abuse, harassment, and intimidation that included an extensive IRS audit. Not to mention this past May, when Comey was interrogated by the Secret Service after posting an Instagram photo of beach shells, spelling out 8647, social media code for removing Trump from office. The question we should be asking is not why the president thinks he can do this, but why so many people outside of New York City, voters numbering in the tens of millions, seem to agree. The Trump of his own golden age was schooled by the Trump of the 40s and 50s, his father. When Barrett, Donald's tenacious biographer, asked Esposito what he knew about Fred Trump, Esposito had a curt and unusual response. He was my friend Willie Tomasello's partner. Tomasello was a mobster, connected to both the Gambino and Genovese families, and the partnership had been formed during the late 1940s, when New York's mayor was William O'Dwyer, and, as Barrett writes, having a mob-connected partner was a way of doing business in New York. O'Dwyer, a former New York City cop, abruptly announced his retirement in 1950 to accept a position as President Harry Truman's ambassador to Mexico. It soon emerged that Truman had given O'Dwyer the plum post to get him out of the country and spare him from incrimination in an emerging Brooklyn rackets scandal. Seen through today's headlines, Truman's O'Dwyer reassignment neatly foreshadows the Trump Justice Department's intervention to protect New York's currently embattled Mayor Eric Adams. Mike O'Dwyer, a former cop, who was rescued when he became embroiled in corruption charges. And here I must remind the listener that this article went to press before the latest elections in New York City. Truman's intervention was a mystery at the time. As far as anyone knew, he didn't like O'Dwyer, just as Trump doesn't seem to like Adams particularly much. Then again, Truman had powerful illicit connections, too, with a Pendergast machine in Kansas City, which imposed its will at election time through what David McCulloch in Truman says were strong-arm tactics at the polls, ballot stuffing, ballot box theft, the buying of votes with whiskey or cash, bloody headlong street brawls, all the odious stratagems that had made big city politics notorious since the time of Boss Tweed. New York remained the capital of bossist politics. It persisted through the 70s and 80s, through the mayoralties of Abe Beam and Ed Koch. Little wonder that Giuliani, who rose to fame in part by prosecuting Maines, should become a conciliere to Boss Trump. In this, he is merely reversing the familiar script of the criminal who flips to the other side, or the prosecutor who finds greater or at least more lucrative rewards in defending the criminally accused. This is the world Trump came of age in. More accurately, the world in which he really did achieve great things, and it's no surprise he wishes to bring it back. On its own terms, it all works. The examples abound, from the radio demagogue Father Coughlin in the 1930s to the Black Panther leader Eldridge Cleaver in the 1960s. Strong and distinctly American voices have advocated for religious, racial, or political violence. In literary circles, the sage of underworld democracy was Norman Mailer, whose work was filled with tabloid pictures of the darkening American dream. "Americans have been leading a double life," he wrote in 1960, "and our history has moved on two rivers, one visible, the other underground. There has been the history of politics, which is concrete, factual, practical, and unbelievably dull. And there is a subterranean river of untapped, lonely, and romantic desires, that concentration of ecstasy and violence which is the dream life of the nation." Mailer wrote this in the excited aftermath of the 1960 Democratic Convention in Los Angeles and its nomination of a libertine, mob-connected, sexual predator, John F. Kennedy, whose playground included the Palm Beach compound owned by his financier father, 5 miles up South Ocean Boulevard from where Mar-a-Lago now stands. JFK's career in the House and Senate had been lackluster, but he had the looks and style of a potential existential hero, Mailer wrote, a Hollywood-style good-bad loner in the mold of Cagney and Bogart, Brando and Sinatra, with his strutter's vow to love well and love many, be cool, be daring, be dashing, be wild, be wily, be resourceful, be a brave gun. Fanboy imagery aside, Mailer was right. Ecstasy and violence did in fact follow. Violence by white sheriffs against civil rights demonstrators in Oxford, Mississippi, and Birmingham, Alabama. Assassinations commissioned by the Kennedy administration with the help of the CIA and the mafia. Silent coups. In sum, a White House-directed murder incorporated, as Kennedy's successor Lyndon Johnson said after the existential hero himself was slain in Dallas in a climax of ecstasy and violence, a climax achieved much sooner than even Mailer had supposed. Mailer's essay was titled Superman Comes to the Supermarket. In those years, the supermarket was the transactional bazaar and also the national newsstand. On the racks near checkout counters, supermen were to be found on the front pages of the newspapers and covers of magazines published by the nation's press lords. But again, there was a second stream. The most democratic of all American newspapers, the true vox populi for generations, avidly read by Trump, was the National Enquirer. We all heard about the Enquirer during Trump's hush money trial last year, but little was said about its powerful imprint on American politics and culture. Reportedly founded with New York mob money, the Enquirer, accompanied some 50 years later by its conjoined twin, Rupert Murdoch's Star, transformed journalism from the 70s to the 90s, through stories of illicit sexual liaisons, and through the hidden system of blackmail its creators practiced to keep stories out of print, the catch and kill discussed at Trump's trial. The same tabloids trafficked in conspiracy theories as well, widening the chinks in the wall between reality and fantasy, between news and nonsense. The publications also provided key hires for the original staff of Murdoch's New York Post and Fox News. In those years, Enquirer-style journalism crept ever closer to the mainstream. One reason Trump so blithely accuses the legacy media of fostering lies is his own successful history in using reputable publications to circulate falsehoods of his own. In Trump's critical first years in Manhattan real estate, the best publicity he got came in the pages of the Times, one flattering story after another on Fred Trump and his wunderkind son, the potential savior of Manhattan. Long before Make America Great Again had come the romantic campaign, part flimflam, part pay-for-play deal-making to make Manhattan Oz again. This was a belated instance of what Nathaniel Hawthorne had discerned all those years ago, the magnetizing effect on statesmen and magistrates, the guardians, the respected voices within the influential classes who joined the inner circle round about the gallows. Now, of course, the price of all this is coming due. The president as celebrity, the tranced reporting of White House gossip, all of it soaked in the excitements of the tabloids of old, and finding newer life on the dark recesses of the web today, have always had a more chilling subtext of retribution and exacted payment of the favor expected in return. It was ever thus. The Puritans' howling wilderness included a shadowy fever swamp from the start. The historian Stacy Schiff has written in this magazine, comparing MAGA world with nefarious pre-colonial forces. Conspiracies invite the arsonist to shout fire. It turns mobs into martyrs. There's a bravado to it, without which it deflates into opera buffa. It is exhilarating on what seems to be a rational level. The pulse quickens as the pieces click into place. Nearly 3.5 centuries after Plymouth Colony was first settled, another historian, Richard Hofstadter, would describe a parallel fanaticism, labeling it the paranoid style in American politics. Gans notes a second connection, the affinities between classic dictatorship and gangland rule. In both cases, it's about getting a piece of the action. Power is domination. Both also nurture zero-sum attitudes toward the world. And they make for natural partnerships. Vladimir Putin and Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, even as they may seek to manipulate Trump, feel a genuine kinship with him. Fascists believe in some kind of national project, over and above the petty instincts of the gangster, says Gans. But at the same time, the gangsters see their own advantage. The two use each other. The difference is that Trump's superpower depends finally on his supporters. He needs the Democratic mob to pursue his own mobster-style ends. There, too, he is an innovator. He has taken the existential idea beyond Mailer's romantic visions of the lone gunman. Mailer's fantasies grew out of old Hollywood and the TV Western, the solo actor and anti-hero acting on his own. Social media in our day has brought us back to the original idea of the mob that Hawthorne gave us. People, lots of them, brought together in collective ecstasy, but also despair. The great majority of the MAGA millions want what most of us do, a shot at the American dream, which they feel Trump's policies might help them realize. The same promise made by the Tammany clubmen of old. Others, the faithful, believe that last July the president was literally saved from assassination by divine intervention. Still others are mischief makers, the doxers and swatters, the armed to the teeth patriots. Each occupies a place in the great democratic panorama. But there is also an unsanctioned force that the president has managed to assemble, one that is unique in American history. It is a network, and it is not unlike the vigilante militias Puzo described as a second and more powerful government. A prescient observer of American gangsterism nearly a century ago was the novelist and later screenwriter Daniel Fuchs, who grew up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, close by Al Capone's old stomping grounds, in a time when New York's poorer neighborhoods were fields of combat for youth gangs. In 1931, when Capone was already the most famous of all mobsters, the virtual monarch of Chicago, at last brought down on tax evasion charges, Fuchs reflected on the route Capone had traveled from boy gang member to adult gangster. The young Capone had been utterly unlike the terrifying criminal of the Prohibition era, a non-entity, affable, soft of speech. Capone was one of many, Fuchs wrote, who had been able to use their boy gangs as a training school for later organized adult gangsterism, in most cases completing their records in jails, in gangs, in rackets and in graves, prosperous and poor, famous and unsung. Trump grasped the latent potential of those other ordinary people, most of them young men, members of the manosphere, who can be mobilized into a force. He tapped into this in the days and months leading up to the attack on the Capitol on January 6, 2021. And upon taking office, he pardoned more than 1,500 of them. They form one faction. He has also signed an executive order intended to allow the American military to perform police functions and granting police immunity from prosecution. He has enlisted law firms to promise to do pro bono work defending cops against accusations of strong-arm behavior. As the Trump administration goes after attorneys and judges, opponents and enemies, real and perceived, one truly twisted idea still resonates. It is an idea he'd proposed during the campaign. It is an idea that would have given even Mailer a jolt. "We need," said candidate Trump, "one really violent day to eradicate crime immediately." Nominally, he was calling for a frenzied few hours in which police could have their way with shoplifters and others. But he was also summoning, in the minds of many, visions of Kristallnacht, of the bloody police crackdown outside the 1968 Democratic Convention, of Pat Buchanan's war whoop at the 1992 Republican Convention, when he discussed how the National Guard had restored order after the L.A. riots. The troopers came up the street, M-16s at the ready, and the mob threatened and cursed. But the mob retreated because it had met the one thing that could stop it: force, rooted in justice and backed by moral courage. Consider one really violent day in the context of recent actions: deportations, detentions defying court orders about immigration policies, and recent propositions: reopen Alcatraz, expand Guantanamo, ship migrants to Libya and Rwanda. And one sees the possible groundwork for the ultimate in power politics, the potential contours of a police state. Amid the Doge deluge, people's tax records and Social Security information and other data were shared with unauthorized authorities. Amid the restructuring of the executive branch, Trump took charge of two previously independent agencies, the NSA and the FBI. In advance of the nationwide hands-off protest in April, security teams put up anti-scaling fencing around the White House. Timed to coincide with his birthday in June, Trump scheduled a full-on military parade. Since January, he has declared 8 national emergencies, from the emergency on the southern border to the fossil fuel emergency. This is the mentality of an outlaw, one well-versed in the legal extremes of martial law, in part because he just might need his enforcers in an emergency. Like FDR before him, Trump has blundered into error. Time and again, the courts, including the Supreme Court, have told him to desist, though they have no power of enforcement. There has been wreckage all along the way. But he also has achieved something no one else has. He has brought Tammany mob rule to the pinnacle of American politics and power. Even the mighty Capone was brought down by the government. Trump, in contrast, has made the executive branch, indeed the three branches of U.S. government, his. And he has done so swiftly, effectively, and in a manner that makes him, to use a Prohibition-era phrase applied to Elliot Ness, the G-Man, who pursued the country's most menacing gangsters, for now, at least, untouchable. As for the fallout from all of this, that's entirely another matter. The whole truth. Mariska Hargitay was just 3 years old when her mother, Jane Mansfield, was killed in a car accident. In a new documentary, the Law and Order star examines her mother's sex symbol status and reveals a long-held family secret by Joy Press. Photographs by Guy Arok, styled by Michele Barati. Opening photo, Mariska Hargitay, photographed on April 30th at Highline Stages in New York City. And next photos, a glamorous Jane Mansfield in 1963, Mansfield holding baby Mariska in 1964, 3 years before the car accident that would take her life. Three-year-old Mariska Hargaday was asleep in the back seat of a car when it rammed into a truck. The toddler survived, her limp little body lodged underneath the passenger seat. But her mother, Hollywood star Jane Mansfield, died instantly. I don't remember the accident. I don't even remember being told that my mother had died, Hargaday tells me nearly 58 years after the crash. She is sitting in her New York City apartment, staring into the black hole where her early memories should be. I look at photos, and I don't really remember anything until I was five. In therapy, Hargaday used to fall asleep any time she wandered too close to painful events, like a narcoleptic. She blamed that on her long hours playing Law and Order, Special Victims Unit's Captain Olivia Benson, work she juggles with her personal life as a mother of three. Eventually, Hargaday's therapist suggested that her sleepiness might be a powerful defense mechanism against trauma. In order to dismantle it, she'd finally have to process the shame she felt about her sex symbol mother and let go of the dark secret about her paternity that she'd been guarding for decades. Don't worry, we'll come to that shortly. And so, during the depths of the pandemic, Hargaday began transforming her personal Pandora's box into Mom Jane, an emotional documentary that premiered May 17th at the 2025 Cannes Film Festival and will air Friday, June 27th on HBO and HBO Max. My Mom Jane is Hargaday's debut as a documentary director, a film she initially saw as an archaeological dig into Mansfield's life. Dubbed Broadway's smartest dumb blonde by Life magazine, Mansfield, born Vera Jane Palmer, was an accomplished young woman who spoke several languages and played violin and piano. But like Hargaday, she'd experienced loss at a young age. Three-year-old Mansfield was in a car with her father when he died of a heart attack. By the time she was 20, she'd gotten married, had a baby, and begun to study acting in college. She moved to Los Angeles with her first child, Mariska's sister, Jane Marie, in 1954, and soon ditched her husband. Mansfield auditioned for a casting agent with a Joan of Arc monologue, vying for serious roles. Then a casting director suggested she try bleaching her hair and wearing tighter dresses. She took that advice and added a breathy Marilyn Monroe-style voice to the mix. Her hope was that once she got her foot in the door, she'd break out of pinup prison. But even after a starring role in the Broadway hit Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter, its film adaptation, and several more big movies, Mansfield struggled to get anyone to see past her breast. In 1962, she played classical violin on Jack Parr's late-night talk show, attempting to introduce America to the real Jane Mansfield. But Parr interrupted her mid-note and shouted crudely, "Who cares? Kiss me." The next year, she starred in Promises, Promises. A mainstream sex comedy, it featured Mansfield in various degrees of nudity and was banned in several American cities. By the time she died in 1967, she had become the floating signifier for a 1950s bombshell, famous mostly for being photographed. Hargaday grew up mortified by this image of her lost mother, a blonde bimbo, the butt of everyone's joke. "It all started with the voice," she remembers. "When I would hear that fake voice, it used to just flip me out. I'd think, why is she talking like that? That's not real." Her father, Miki Hargaday, a Hungarian bodybuilding champion turned actor, who married Mansfield in 1956 and raised their three children after she died, would insist that this was just her public image. "My dad would always say, she wasn't like that at all. She was like you. She was funny and irreverent and fearless and real." But for Hargate, educated in Los Angeles Catholic schools, it was hard to swallow. I just wanted my mom to be like the other moms. Like, why are you always in a bathing suit? Why so much breast? I just wanted a maternal mother image, she says, burying her head in her hands. I was embarrassed by the choices that she made. When I mentioned the famous photo of Sophia Loren glancing sidelong at Mansfield's exposed bosom, Hargate's face crumples. That was a rough one. To see another woman look at your mom like that was excruciating for me as a little girl. All of this trickled down into Hargate's own sense of self. She played sports in high school, leaning toward a tomboyish aesthetic. I didn't want to be that girl, and I was judgmental about it. That's the honest answer, she says. I definitely think that it informed some of my choices. What kind of actor am I going to be? I am going to be a different kind. It's probably not an accident that she spent 26 years inside the character of Olivia Benson, one of the fiercest, most nurturing female characters on television. I've had so much strife and turmoil with this word mother, and here I was, this iconic mother figure in the culture. Isn't that ironic? Though Hargate had mommy problems growing up, her late father, Mickey, was beyond reproach. He was my everything, my idol. He loved me so much, and I knew it, she says, her voice wavering. I also knew something else. I just didn't know what I knew. Hargate had always felt that she was different from her siblings, but it wasn't until her 20s that she understood why. In 1963, Mansfield filed for divorce from Mickey and began a well-publicized romance with an Italian entertainer named Nelson Sardelli, only to reconcile with Mickey several months before Hargate's birth in 1964. In her 20s, someone showed Hargate a photo of Sardelli. She immediately knew in her bones that he was her biological father. It was like the floor fell out from underneath me, she recalls in My Mom Jane, like my infrastructure dissolved. But when she confronted Mickey, he denied it. The encounter was so shattering that she swept the skeleton back under the family rug and never mentioned Sardelli to Mickey again. Mickey died in 2006. When she was 30, Hargate went to see Sardelli perform in Atlantic City and introduced herself. He burst into tears, telling her, I've been waiting 30 years for this moment. It wasn't a fairy tale scene for Hargate, though. I went full Olivia Benson on him, she tells me, switching into an icily aggressive voice. I was like, I don't want anything. I don't need anything from you. I have a dad. She pauses dramatically. There was something about loyalty. I wanted to be loyal to Mickey. In the aftermath, Hargate struggled to navigate the internal gymnastics of knowing I'm living a lie my entire life. Is this why she'd always felt so comfortable on family trips to Rome, accompanying Mickey while he acted in spaghetti westerns? Was she Hungarian or Italian, a wanted child, or an illegitimate mistake? Hargate gradually forged a bond with Sardelli and his daughters and came to a realization. Her mother had returned to Mickey because she knew he would love and provide a stable home for baby Mariska. I grew up where I was supposed to, and I do know that everyone made the best choice for me, she says. I'm Mickey Hargate's daughter. That is not a lie. Her eyes fill with tears. This documentary is kind of a love letter to him because there's no one that I was closer to on this planet. Hargate points out that two of her own children are adopted. They are my kids. Now I understand so much, and boy, is it sweet. Getting loved ones to understand why she needed to make the documentary wasn't easy. So many people were really hesitant for me to do it, Hargate says. But in time, both families gave her their blessing and agreed to appear in the film as well. Sardelli went first, making himself vulnerable on camera. Childhood pain and confusion are palpable in her interviews with her siblings, Jane Marie Mansfield, Zoltan Hargate, and Mickey Hargate Jr. Watching the finished doc with them in a Los Angeles screening room was a cathartic experience. Memory fragments you in so many ways, so to see the story organized felt like, oh, now we can deal with that, Hargitay says. The four of them sat, arms linked, throughout the film. A separate private screening for her Sardelli sisters in Las Vegas felt equally profound. They just wept and wept and wept, Hargitay recalls, then begins to cry herself. These two women that I love so much, I made them secrets. It's so heartbreaking to me. She remembers the countless times she introduced them to people as family friends, then guiltily looked away. I'm not good with lies, so I also made this movie to unburden all of us. Hargitay sees a link between the familial silence breaking of my mom, Jane, and her work with her Joyful Heart Foundation, a nonprofit for survivors of sexual assault, domestic violence, and child abuse. In 2017, she produced I Am Evidence, a documentary about thousands of unprocessed rape kits languishing in America's police lockers. Last year, she revealed that she had been raped by a friend during her 30s. That was my own parallel journey with shame and not wanting to carry that anymore, she says, wanting for so long to be free of the secret. I Am Evidence, directed by Trish Adlesic, who is also a producer of My Mom, Jane, and Gita Gandbir, made Hargitay fall in love with filmmaking, and she plans to make more documentaries. That's one of the things I'm carving out in my future at SVU, making sure that I can have the balance. When I ask about the fate of television's longest-running character, she clutches her heart. I'm not done with Olivia Benson yet, she replies. She's got more work to do. As we speak, though, Hargitay is preparing herself for My Mom Jane's premiere at Cannes. Mansfield appeared at the festival in 1958, leaving behind a trail of glamorous photos. There's Mansfield posing in a bikini with a chihuahua. Mansfield waving from the airplane steps. Mansfield in a gown, facing a wall of photographers. Always smiling, always in character as Jane Mansfield, bombshell. The fact that I get to take her back and to tell her story there, I just don't have the words, Hargitay tells me, vibrating with nervous excitement. As we finish our conversation, she thinks about everything it took to get her to this point. 30 years, and now it's coming out. It's wild. She beams so hard, I worry that her cheeks might explode. I feel like I'm 7. we nominate for Oblivion Orange Wine. In a revival of a Jazz Age Vanity Fair column, one writer explores how a modest experiment in winemaking has fermented into a nightmare. By Byron Hudier. Orange wine enthusiast will tell you it harks back to ancient Georgia, to wine aged in buried kevri and liberated from modern interference. Archaic methods, the thrill of the authentic for a wine more alive and expressive, a purer conduit for terroir and truth. What began as an earnest flirtation with low-intervention winemaking has curdled into something faintly cultish, oxidized, seditious liquids sloshed from reclaimed carafes in Bushwick, Kreuzberg, or in Hackney, praised in reverent tones by men in harem pants and cycling caps. Against better judgment, I have tried these orange wines, egged on by sommelier with the sort of facial hair that suggests either deep conviction or an elaborate dare. These wines appear smugly on menus alongside foraged disappointment served on filament-lit sharing plates. Cider aged in a dried boot, redolent of barnyard regret. Orange wine is a low sulfite con, a prolonged student prank passed off as enlightenment. And like many student pranks, it smells of manure and failure. There is a juvenile glee in rejecting filtration, stability, or even consistency as moral virtues. Murkiness isn't a feature, it's a flaw. This is not progress. It is a collapsed scaffolding of taste. Real wine is civilization bottled, transfigured by soil, sunlight, and savoir-faire into a triumph of memory over impulse. One of the few things humanity has tangibly improved upon with age, error, and the exquisite tyranny of tradition, real wine is the triumph of method over mayhem. Under the stewardship of monks, vintners, and noble hoarders, craft became culture. Natural wine's unpredictability fatally obliterates one of wine's most important uses. It acts in concert with food. A great bottle can solo, but it harmonizes best in symphony as part of an orchestra. Orange wine does not reliably present as red or white, nor as light or full-bodied. It is a roulette wheel of tannin and acidity. A zealot wine bar will persist in a charade of specificity, stage whispering elaborate tasting notes and rules about pairing, when in truth the outcome is a pot shot. By contrast, in the high temples of good wine, like Le Bon Georges in the 9th arrondissement, the sommelier never misses. Every bottle earns its place. Here, nuance and humility reign. The wine list is longer than a glam rocker's mercifully shelved erotic memoirs, and its vintage likely more appropriate. Quality rules here. Sometimes this includes orange wine, but it is offered in context, not blind zeal. Natural wine, by contrast, is curated anarchy, a celebration of faults dressed up as favor, as flavor. Volatile acidity, oxidation, brettomyces, all indulged and rebranded as expressive. One might as well declare damp plaster textured or stale bread whimsical. Drinking orange wine is like being mugged by a wellness retreat. A wine that tastes like unwashed radish water may well be sincere. That doesn't mean it deserves a second glass, let alone a movement. Wine should elevate, not assault. There's no virtue in the sensory equivalent of a slap. Wine need not be reinvented. It needs to be protected, not as a relic, but as a repository of accumulated excellence. That's not elitism, it's gratitude. So the next time someone pours you something that smells like silage and insists it's alive, feel free to agree and banish it to oblivion. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with a painting by David Hockney. Larry Gagosian, the world's grandest art dealer and new owner of Bookhampton, the celebrated tome slinger to East End Brahmins on Summering and Capri, wading in warm St. Bart's waters, his custom-made pool cue, and sitting for David Hockney. What is your idea of perfect happiness? A good night's sleep. What is your greatest fear? Antibiotic-resistant infection. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Casanova. What do you dislike most about your appearance? A few years ago, I was very fortunate that David Hockney asked if he could paint my portrait, and I think it turned out great. Over the 3 days that I sat for him, I did my best to keep my stomach flat, but when I saw the finished painting, it was clear that I had not succeeded. What is your greatest extravagance? My custom-made pool cue. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Ghosting. What is your favorite journey? Climbing the stairs to Casa Malaparte in Capri every summer. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? frugality. Which living person do you most despise? Guess. Which word or phrase do you most overuse? What the F? What is your greatest regret? I did not stick with my piano lessons as a kid. When and where were you happiest? Swimming in the ocean in St. Bart's. Which talent would you most like to have? I really wish I could tap dance. What is your current state of mind? Productively confused. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? My impatience. What do you consider your greatest achievement? My gallery. What is your most treasured possession? My restaurant, Capo Massa. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Loneliness. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I wish I'd gotten to know them better. What is your favorite occupation? Luckily, the one that I have. Who are your favorite writers? Raymond Chandler and Emma Klein. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Leonardo da Vinci, who was both real and mythical. Who are your heroes in real life? I have always been more drawn to the anti-heroes. What are your favorite names? Cy and Bryce. What is it that you most dislike when there are not enough chocolate chips in a scoop of chocolate chip ice cream? How would you like to die in 100 years on Mars? What is your motto? Only the paranoid survive. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Larry Gagosian. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.